Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of November 14th, 2014. First, however, for example, moreover. When you're learning to write, there's a reason teachers give you a lot of words for transitions. They happen all the time. People grow, age, change. So do industries, even economies. Indeed, that's another transition word there, they're probably changing more often than not. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Our show this week is about, yep, transitions. In an economic sense, sure, but also in our lives, like in how the baby boomer retirement is driving urban planning, or how our need for the next new phone creates waste in West Africa. We want to hear about your transitions. Write us at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. Now let's start the show and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
Today, six of the world's biggest banks will be fined around £1.5 billion by the Financial Conduct Authority for misconduct in the £3 trillion a day market.
Well, as President Obama attends trade talks in China, he used a video message on Monday to issue a strong statement in favor of a free and open internet.
President Barack Obama announced that the U.S. is actually going to move much faster in cutting levels of pollution. And Chinese President Xi Jinping also agreed to cap China's emissions in the future.
We're going to start with a big transition in education. It's driven by data. Schools and states gather a lot of data on kids. We've talked about that before on this show. They're using it in the classroom to make school services more efficient and even predict the future. Yeah. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is looking at this for Learning Curve, our project on education and technology. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie.
Adrian, you and I have talked before about data collection as, you know, a way to improve education overall. But now we're talking about predicting kids' futures. How does that work?
Yeah, it's pretty sci-fi, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
The idea is there's this huge amount of student-level data out there now on kids. Researchers have been poring over this data for a long time, looking for correlations they can find. And one thing they've figured out is you can look at data about things like students' attendance and their grades and really spot early on which kids are at risk of dropping out of high school. And this is before they're ever in high school.
Wow. So when do they start actually tracking the data?
Well, they start tracking the data from a really early age, but they start making these predictions oftentimes at the ninth grade year, sometimes in middle school. But we're starting to see people now making these predictions for at risk of dropping out of high school as early as first and second grade. So really early in a kid's educational career.
What kinds of data do schools use to figure out who's at risk?
Well, this is pretty basic data. So schools and their contractors are collecting all sorts of data, but the data they use for these at-risk predictions are really basic. Again, there are things like a kid's attendance record, their GPA, maybe test scores, maybe behavior information. And they're able to look at that, compare it to previous cohorts, and figure out which kids are on track and which kids aren't.
So they got all this stuff, then what do they do?
Well, best case scenario, they take this data, they run it through their sort of prediction system, they flag kids who are at risk, and they act on it. So they say, look, Lizzie is showing up as having risk factors that make us think she might not finish high school, and then they figure out what's wrong with Lizzie, or at least try to figure it out, and then they come up with ways to help to get you back on track.
How common is this kind of program?
It is incredibly common. A group called the Data Quality Campaign says at least 30 states out there are using early warning systems, coming up with these reports, but they're also used at the district and school level. So they're really all over the place.
It also sounds like there is the potential for tracking a kid, and tracking can be a dirty word in education. How do they make that calculation and whether there are some squishy lines here?
Well, it's definitely something that schools and researchers are struggling with, because at the end of the day, you don't want teachers to see a kid flagged at risk and give up on the kid. You don't want a parent or a student even sort of knowing that they're labeled at risk. You know, Because if I have a big at-risk flag next to my name and I know about it, am I really going to come in and think I can succeed? I talked to a principal named Kelly Birch at a school in Vacaville, California about this. She says at her school, kids and their parents never know they're on these at-risk lists.
But the kids, you know, I want them to come in and think that they're great and they can do anything. And I don't want to give them any reason to think that they couldn't.
You don't just want to label a kid, and you don't want that label to spell their destiny. That's the trick here. So everyone I talk to about these prediction systems say flagging has to be followed by the hard work of a school to really figure out what's going on and then how to help a kid in trouble.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports for our Learning Curve project. Adrian, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Each week, we ask our listeners to talk to us online and on the radio. This week's question was, how do you profit from your passion? And many of you responded. Chris Guillebeau, the author of The Happiness of Pursuit, joins me now to talk about your pursuits and maybe how to make a transition in your life. Hi, Chris. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to start by playing a comment from a listener who was laid off from her job at a museum, and then she sort of took what she was doing at the museum and started doing it on her own without the museum. Let's listen to that.
Hi, I'm Jane Snellcoats, and I live outside of St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm a chemist. I'd been downsized from a job at a big museum that I absolutely loved. I just kind of thought, well, maybe I could do a lot of this work on my own. And I can. So that's my plan, and I'm sticking with it.
Do you have other examples of when this has happened, when people, you know, in this economy maybe have lost a job, but take the germ of what they love and are able to move forward with that?
You know, I hear from people all the time who, you know, either kind of stumble into something like this or just like that caller, maybe they've been laid off or they have to make this transition or they're just trying to make a second act, and they focus on something that they're good at. They focus on something that they're passionate about, and they do that without going to business school. They do that without going into debt. And really the lesson is that everyone's good at something.
I want to talk a little bit about fear, because I think that's something that can hold people back. Our next clip is from a listener who has a job as a database manager, but he loves music, and he wants to make that his career. So let's listen to that.
My name is Bob Clayton. I'm from Eugene, Oregon. And I have created about 12 albums of music for guitar players to play along with. Just I slowed down on the recording, and I'm trying to do the marketing. And as an artist, you know, the marketing is a lot less exciting than actually recording. But I do need to really expose the music to more people, and I'm a single dad, and I'm doing this music business on the side, and there's just is never enough time to do all the social media stuff that really needs to happen.
So how do you do that? How do you make that step from that business on the side that you want to promote, but if you're, say, a single parent or someone with limited time, you know, you still got to pay the bills. And how do you make that into a full-time thing? You've talked to a lot of people, and you've written about startups getting things off the ground.
You know, sometimes I think it's a benefit to only have a small amount of time. Maybe the first lesson is don't quit your day job. You know, let's spend 20 minutes every morning working on that business, you know, doing that social media that he mentioned. Let's get a one-page website. Let's get a PayPal account if you don't have one already.
There are a lot of tools out there that exist now that didn't exist, you know, 5-10 years ago. So we're going to listen to a comment from a woman who makes glass beads. She had an office job, but she started selling glass beads with her daughter and then pretty soon was selling them online on Etsy. Listen to this.
My name is Lori Ament. I'm talking to you from beautiful Lansing, New York. I started at farmers markets, which I love. Etsy, I heard about through somebody one day, thought I'd give it a shot. It took a while for it to get off the ground, but it finally did a couple years later. You have to put in some energy. And I also sell through Facebook, which is a new surprising thing. You know, somebody asked me once, well, why would somebody buy your glass beads online? You know, I mean, they can't touch them, they can't see them. You know, they can see the pictures, but it's go look around and try to find your local lampwork glass bead maker, and you'll know why people buy them online. A lot of groups, like the lampwork glass bead makers, have kind of allied themselves with each other to try to make it a little easier to find what they do.
What do you think are the pros and cons of going online?
I mostly see pros because your investment is so low and your ability to reach people is so far and wide. You know, I used to live in West Africa, spent a lot of time in villages in Sierra Leone and Liberia. And if you go out into the village, everyone is an entrepreneur, essentially. Like, everyone is kind of buying and selling, and, you know, they have this entrepreneurial mindset because there's very little formal economy. But for the most part, if you live in the village in West Africa, you can only sell to people, you know, in that village, in that network. But people like Lori, you know, have this ability to connect with people all over the world. The potential is so, so much greater to reach people, you know, wherever they are, you know, through the internet these days.
Have you ever said to someone, you know what, this doesn't seem to be working out? Have you ever said, maybe don't follow that passion?
Absolutely. I think there are lots of times when you should give up, you know, like this advice about never give up is terrible advice, in my opinion. How do you know? I guess you know when you're no longer excited about something and there's not much of a market response. You know, if those two things are true, if you're not motivated to keep going and people don't care, then you should give up and try something else. I don't necessarily think everyone wants to follow their passion into entrepreneurship. If you just like to do something and you don't necessarily like to teach people about it, you don't necessarily want to do any of that branding work. If you just like playing music, you don't care about making it a business, there's nothing wrong with that. But I would say, you know, why not consider merging these worlds of something that you love to do and that's something that provides you income?
Chris Guillebeau is the author of The $100 Startup. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And suddenly, Thanksgiving is creeping up on us. Many of you might be picking up a turkey or some new sheets for visiting family. Thanksgiving can be expensive, and we want to hear your stories about how you've made Thanksgiving make financial sense for you. Tell us by visiting marketplaceweekend.org, or you can tweet us. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
So, you have tuppence. May I be permitted to see it?
No, I want it to feed the birds.
Fiddlesticks, boy. Feed the birds, and what have you got? Fat birds.
This is Tech in Real Life.
This week, we took an informal survey by asking people in the financial district of Los Angeles, when was the last time you went to the bank?
Where I went inside of a bank.
Oh, do I go to the bank?
The bank. Well, I have an online bank now, so.
Yeah, most of it is online.
Online, yeah, yeah.
I use the ATM to get cash out. That's about it.
I never see my money. It's all digital.
Children growing up are losing because they don't know what money really looks like.
I just like doing things more hands-on, and sometimes when I do things online, I lose track of things a bit easier. So
I wouldn't say not going to the bank is a big loss for me.
Sometimes I'll go to like the grocery store and get cash back then.
Oh, I need to start my 401k. You know, I have a lot of trouble going in through like a FAQ online and having that describe completely and entirely what I need to do.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. He took me to a place where apparently a lot of you aren't going.
We're standing outside of my bank right now.
And my bank, actually.
Shall we name it? Bank of America?
Yeah, it's our
we
bank.
Might as well admit
you know,
it.
We heard those clips of a bunch of people.
Yes.
They don't sound like they go to the bank a lot.
No, I think a lot of people these days are banking online or banking mobily. Like, I use my bank's app all the time, for instance, to do everything from check balances to send transfers. Checking has also, in a way, been replaced by some of these services we've talked about on the show, like Venmo. Remember when we Venmo'd together, got some
yes.
ice cream? So PayPal, Venmo, services like that, in some ways, are replacing checking because people can trade money. And you don't need an ATM for that kind of stuff.
one of the results of all of this is that millennials bank really differently. I mean, the numbers are 63% of, you know, that demographic. So we're talking young adults, 18 to 29, don't even have a credit card. And what, about 23% of them only have one card?
Yes.
What changed? What happened there?
All right, so there's a few different factors. A lot of people coming out of the recession did try and change their behaviors as they related to credit, right, and change their habits around credit. A lot of millennials are also dealing with a lot of student debt. So
they're not thinking about getting a mortgage, maybe,
quite yet. Right.
Okay.
So I think that's maybe at play here. A lot of this stuff is also the kind of gamification of banking and finance that's happening here. You can actually use something like Smart Bank or any number of other apps that kind of almost make it fun to do some of this stuff.
Creating a 401k and savings and, you know, the longer term, bigger picture, becoming a grown-up,
the
money
olds.
Stuff, the old stuff, the stuff that,
that
you
we
learn
do.
How to do, that we do. Right. Where are all the happy, fun things for that? Do they exist yet? Are they going to exist?
They're starting to emerge. Now, it is true that a lot of this, I think, more complicated stuff, like maybe starting your own retirement account or saving for a child or starting a trust or things like that, these things are not fully in the digital space yet, right? There's a company in Boston called Society of Grownups. They have classes for millennials who want to learn about more about their finances. Classes include freelance and fromage on how to keep free of like a freelance
Mon
budget.
Dieu.
So the company's doing really well, which may be part of why bigger banks are starting to dip their toes into these kinds of online resources as well.
Is technology going to kind of catch up with this stuff overall, right? I mean, if you have this large group of millennials, they're going to need to have 401ks. They're
yes.
going to need Roth IRAs, right?
Yes.
And they are going to want to pay someone to manage those at some point, I assume.
It's weird to think, but a lot of people who are just now getting into banking never went like you and I did through the drive-through bank teller and put the, you know, the tube into the tube and made it go, or never went maybe to a teller to
and
open their checking account.
They never went inside this door,
yeah.
right in there, 5 feet from us.
Right. And even I, Lizzie, I go in the bank maybe once a month. This stuff is changing. It is going to be built out in the near future. I think we're going to see a lot more services do this kind of thing.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Get some of our tech in your life. You can download the Marketplace app from the iTunes Store or on Google Play.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. For about half a century, American cities and suburbs were built as car towns, with long stretches of road, sometimes no sidewalks. But lately, urban planners and, more importantly, Americans like to be a little more intimate. Millennials don't seem to want to buy cars or drive that much. And they're teaming up with some unlikely allies in the quest for more walkable cities. Retirees. As the baby boomer generation ages, more and more of them want to stay at home, stay independent, and be able to get around. To better understand what walkable cities mean to the aging population, I took a walk in Washington, D.C. Tori Goldhammer, an occupational therapist and fall prevention expert, came with me, and so did another special guest.
My name is Buck O'Leary. I'm your father.
Oh, my goodness!
Yeah.
We are out at Eastern Market, which is an older part of the city in Washington, D.C. We've got a lot of brick sidewalks and some uneven streets, old trees. This is an historical neighborhood. And, Troy, tell me if I'm right here, but
this seems like a place where you have a lot of different walkways for pedestrians that would be a little bit more complicated to navigate.
Yes, because it's a historical area, there are a lot of brick sidewalks, which is part of the historical feel of the city. And the bricks are notorious for coming up, for being uplifted by roofs, for being slippery when they become wet or if it's cold outside. So it can be a very difficult area to navigate. And the trees in particular seem to cause a lot of trouble in our neighborhood and a lot of the neighborhoods in D.C.
I want to take a walk and kind of get a sense of what this looks like, what it feels like, and what different options are for cities around the country as they deal with basically aging baby boomers.
So you can see here an example of, you know, we have the brick sidewalks here, and then they have some of the newer curb cuts that they've been putting in over the past few years. And what you'll notice about the curb cuts, which are the indentations at the bottom of the sidewalk, is that they have textured grooves in them so that they provide some traction as you're walking down them. And then they also have the raised bumps at the bottom, and these are for people with visual impairments so they can use their canes. It's funny that I learned how important these are because I raised my daughter here in the neighborhood, and with the stroller, it's, you know, incredibly useful to have these curb cuts. So you sort of realize when you have a different stage of life that it can really be useful at all stages of life and for everybody.
Now that I'm here with you, I'm seeing, you know, here's brick sidewalk in front of us, and that looks a little scary.
It is, you know, and it really anything greater than a quarter of an inch in change of height can present a trip risk for anybody.
If you weren't walking with us, would you notice those?
Probably not. Probably would not have my eye out for that, unfortunately.
What do you think would happen?
I might go stumble and go splat in some ungracious way.
Never. You would never fall ungraciously.
I have.
And I think one of the problems is that as we age, unfortunately, we're more predisposed to falling. Your general balance is a little bit off. And so there's a combination of factors that make you sort of even more prone to these risks in the sidewalks. And now we're going on to this more concrete paver sort of area. And these tend to still work pretty well because the trees don't uproot these quite as much as they do the bricks back there.
How's this part for you, Dad?
Good. It's good. I mean, this surface, I can see where this surface is helpful.
This is easier than the brick?
Yes. Less chance of stumbling, you know.
Yeah, and you'll notice that when the main shopping areas of the city or the main tourist areas of the city, the sidewalks tend to be in very good shape. But as you get back into the neighborhoods where people live, it tends to get worse and worse.
We're in, I would say, a city that's probably kind of in the middle, right? I mean, D.C.'s got some spots that are really walkable, and then some spots where, gosh, you need a car to get anywhere. How does D.C. stack up to other cities?
Compared to New York, one of the nice things that New York has done is there's a lot more seating surfaces, which is actually like a huge thing for actually becoming an age-friendly
city. Yeah,
there's
nowhere for us to sit
down. There's nowhere to sit down.
We can't take a break.
No. So what we end up doing here in D.C. is if somebody needs to sit, we have to suggest that they have one of the walkers that has a seat on it. But then that gives them a sort of stigma. One of the other big issues that we face in the city as well, particularly here, it's a problem that the major thoroughfares, the time to cross the street is much shorter than it is to cross the side streets.
Yeah.
And hopefully there's an island or a median that you can stop and take a rest at, but often there's not. So there might be six lanes of traffic, and it's 22 seconds to get across the street, and it's really, really, very, very difficult. So that's another thing that we're trying to work on.
Dad, I'm going to put you on the spot. What concerns you? You've got stairs that go up to your house. You've got stairs up to the second floor. You've got at least one dog who likes to take you out at the knees if she has the chance.
And she's done that.
Do you think about this stuff?
I do, yes, I do. I am the principal dog walker in our family, and one of our dogs is 2 years old, and she can really run, and she loves to run. And she loves to run close to me. And I have been felled a couple of times by the dogs. It's something certainly that's on my mind. And there are a lot of steps in D.C. that I find that have no railing. Sometimes, you know, that can present a challenge for somebody my age.
You're turning 77.
Yes.
How much does thinking about mobility weigh on you? Does it?
Yes, it does. I mean, I know that my balance is not as good as it once was. I do some exercises to try and maintain my balance, and that's great, but that doesn't cover the situation where a problem comes up in a very impromptu, sudden way, and you have to deal with it. That's when you're in danger of falling.
hopefully the individuals that are aging will understand the risks of fall as you age, what happens to your body, and that there are things that you can do to mitigate those risks. So sort of a combination of working with the city and making the environment safer, as well as helping the person understand what their own individual risks are and hopefully mitigating those risks, like exercising, as you were talking about. It's important to sort of look at the complete picture, looking at the person and the environment and the interaction of those two things, and really trying to solve as many problems as you can.
Tori Goldhammer, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was very nice meeting you.
And Buck O'Leary, Dad, thank you.
Well, thank you, too.
To follow up on my walk, I spoke to one of the AARP lobbyists pushing for age-friendly cities nationwide. Her name is Nancy Lamond, and she's the executive vice president of the AARP. Nancy, welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you.
You know, I took a walk in Washington, D.C., my hometown, and also the city where you're based.
Yes.
We walked with an occupational therapist, and we walked with my dad, and I saw a variety of things. You know, some places where it's pretty easy, and then some places where the brick is uneven or the intersections are very wide and it's hard to cross. How do you go about fixing that? And how is it different in different parts of the country? I mean, Washington's a fairly urban place, but someplace like Los Angeles is a car town.
Well, we've done walking audits in over 40 cities and towns across the country. And just walk the city or the town block and look, as you and your dad did, at what's going on underfoot and around them. And there are a lot of commonalities. The environment may be different, but there are some of the same problems. All of these things are important to address, not only for older citizens, but also for younger.
How much money does it cost to make these kinds of changes?
Well, it depends. There are many places where there's a lot of construction underway, and they're already making changes to the physical environment, and ensuring that it's done in the right way often doesn't add very many costs at all. In other places, we have an example in Wichita, Kansas, where there was a vacant lot that the city was maintaining, and a group of our members came together, kind of looked at it and said, well, this would be a great place to have a park, and it's now called Grandparents Park. It's built with equipment for young kids and exercise equipment for grandparents. One thing we know is that the more walkable an environment or a community is, the more the value of the property is going to be higher. And so there is an incentive for communities to look at this in more than just safety and mobility of its residents. It's also a very good investment for property values.
It cannot escape the notice of the leadership of various communities that the AARP is the eighth largest lobbying organization in the country, and its members tend to vote, and vote pretty consistently.
Well, that's certainly true. And in local communities, I think what's even more powerful, frankly, than the vote every 2 or every 4 years is that our members tend to be participants in the community. They come to community meetings. They're very involved. And I think that's awfully important.
How much money are you all putting behind this campaign?
Well, at the moment, I'm not quite sure. We've been investing over the last few years, probably a couple of $1 million as we do our work across the country. But I think what's most important is not our investment alone of dollars, but the kinds of resources we're able to leverage, the volunteer time of our members, participation of other community groups representing all ages.
You really don't know the bottom line?
The bottom line for us? I think we've probably invested about $2 million.
The baby boom generation is retiring, and they are very large and very vocal. What are they telling you about the kinds of communities that they want to live in? And are they different from even people 10, 20 years older than they are?
Well, one thing they're telling us loud and clear is that they want to stay in their homes and in their communities as long as possible. What they're looking for in communities, I think, is what all generations are. They're looking for safe areas. They're looking for good housing, transportation, being able to be involved socially. They want to be engaged in a way that's meaningful.
Nancy Lemond, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the weekend number, 63. 63% of baby boomers intend to stay in their homes as they age. That's according to a study by the Conference Board and Nielsen. But a study from Harvard and the AARP says most homes will need some kind of modification to allow that to happen. There's a lot to mull over in the economy this week. Plus, it's the weekend, so let's have brunch. We are out having brunch at the Pullman Kitchen in New York on 2nd Avenue, and today I have with me John Cassidy, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and Allison Griswold, covers business and economics for Slate. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Cheers to you both. Welcome. I want to start, John, with something that I think is relevant in the wake of the midterm elections. And it's sort of where economic policy interacts and intersects with a lot of people's lives. I've been looking at wages and where they hit most people's pocketbooks. And there's this question of wage stagnation in America. The Democratic Party has always said, we're the party of working families, and yet under the Democratic Party, wages haven't really budged in any meaningful sense. What do you think happens going forward now? We're seeing this shift in Congress.
Right.
Do you think we start to see any change in people's pocketbooks?
Well, I think before you figure out what's going to happen going forward, you need to look back a bit, because this is a very old story. It really started in the late 70s. And it's gone on regardless of which party has been in power. The only time in the last 30 years we've had any real wage growth for middle-income families is in the late 90s under the Clintons.
Under the Clintons, yeah.
So actually, that would suggest that it sort of happens regardless of what the policy is. But I don't think that's totally true. If you think what happened back in the late 90s, the unemployment rate fell to very low rates, below 5% at one point. That's sort of encouraging because the unemployment rate's falling again. It's down to 5.8%. So if there's any hope, if unemployment rate gets back below 5.5%, which most economists regard as sort of the so-called natural rate of unemployment.
Allison, you wrote about one of the places where some of these jobs are being created, or I guess we should say some of the creativity is being exercised at Pizza Hut, which is not a place I generally think of. Spinach and caramelized, shallots and all these things? It's like every possible pizza topping known to man being thrown on a pizza. Why is this happening?
Pizza Hut is one of a couple of fast food chains that are really struggling to rebrand. The fastest growing segment in the restaurant industry right now is what's called fast casual. And so that's what you think of as Chipotle and Panera and these places where you're essentially getting fast food, but the ambiance is a little nicer and the food quality feels a little better. And because of that, places like Pizza Hut and Taco Bell and McDonald's are all really losing out. One of the strategies to compensate for that has been to launch this huge rebrand.
I wonder if there's any connection between the people I'm asking you about and those restaurants, who they're trying to appeal to.
I think there surely is. It's been true for decades that the sort of fastest growing segments of U.S. retail, you know, the low end, you see it in Walmart. And Allison's talking about some of these chains going a bit up market, but which McDonald's did, I think, a year or two ago, if you remember, they introduced new coffee and they actually introduced salads, as I recall. The problem they always face these places is most of their customers are still very budget conscious. So I don't know how Pizza Hut's tackling this one, you know.
What you're talking about is why places like Red Lobster and Olive Garden really aren't doing well, because they were traditionally the nice dinner out for a middle-class family. They're suffering because they're stuck right in the middle where they're not nice enough for someone who's more upper class to go there, and they're too expensive for the people who have lost out to go anymore. And so that's why you've seen those chains do really badly recently.
You also wrote about a place that is doing incredibly well, the phenomenon of Singles Day, which is just absolutely massive in China. Can you explain Singles Day and the $9 billion shopping phenomenon behind it?
Sure. Singles Day was started by a couple students at a university in China in the 90s. And the theory initially was just that it's sort of the anti-Valentine's Day, which is just what it sounds like. But then it was picked up just a couple years ago by Alibaba, the huge e-commerce giant that's basically like eBay and Amazon combined. And it was rebranded as this online shopping holiday that's now bigger than our Cyber Monday and Black Friday together. So it's really, really well marketed and built up. You know, Alibaba has countdowns to it and all these things to get people excited. And they did tremendous sales volume.
$9 billion.
Yes.
I mean, can you think of an American company that has done $9 billion in business in a day?
I can't know, but big question has been last 10, 15 years economically. Are they going to transition from a manufacturing exporter to a consumer society? The success of Singles Day would suggest, yes, they are.
And, that's, you know, a resounding yes.
Yeah.
But the other problem is that their website, AliExpress, which is what works with basically people outside of China, just has a lot of issues with fraud and deals that aren't really deals, and weeding through those has been a problem for a lot of consumers. You know, you see a watch for 10 cents and it looks great, but you might have to order 100 of them and they might never show up.
It's sort of like Canal Street on the internet.
Yeah.
My other favorite story that kind of gets to the nature of what is real and what is not is this threatened court battle between Unilever, which is the big company behind Hellmann's mayonnaise, and the startup company Hampton Creek and their product called Just Mayo, which is, I guess, according to the Food and Drug Administration, not technically mayonnaise because it doesn't contain an egg. And they have been going back and forth over this, which I find totally fascinating. I mean, it's this weird little PR battle. I kind of keep wondering if this is just something that was dreamt up by really, really clever public relations executives to get people to buy more of the Just Mayo.
It seems to me like another case where one of these organic natural food companies are marketing themselves as a rival to the big evil multinational, which is, you know, giving you sort of an egg-based mayonnaise.
They had their best sales day ever.
Yeah, and then Unilever have fallen into the trap by suing them, which exactly gives them enormous amount of free publicity. So it sounds like the, you know, the evil multinational screwed up here. It sort of is interesting, I guess, from a sort of etymological basis. You know, is there a difference between mayo and mayonnaise? Because I understand that's the manufacturer's defense, that we're not calling this mayonnaise, we're calling it mayo. Presumably that'll be hashed out in court if it ever gets that far.
John Cassidy from The New Yorker, Allison Griswold from Slate, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What are you and your friends talking about over your brunch this weekend? We want to know. You can tell us by visiting marketplaceweekend.org or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. When we talk about transitions in our daily lives, often it's trying to figure out how to squeeze out 20 minutes to do that thing you love. You know, the whole work-life balance. I sometimes hate that phrase. But business coach Lauren Bacon came up with something different. It's a matrix. One vertical line, one horizontal, with four quadrants. I'm going to let her explain how it works.
The vertical axis, from bottom to top, it goes from depleting your energy to energizing you. And then the other axis, the horizontal axis, goes from left to right, other people's priorities, and then there's a spectrum over to your priorities. So we find on the left upper side would be things that are energizing, but that are other people's priorities. So for a lot of us, that might be where our vocation lies, right? It's something that really brings us some joy, but we do it primarily because somebody else is asking us to do it. The upper right quadrant is the stuff that I call fun and purpose. It's where fun and purpose overlap.
And what goes in those bottom two quadrants that go down toward the depleting side of things?
The lower left quadrant I call drudgery. It's the stuff that's both depleting and at somebody else's priority. And we all have some of this in our life, but the goal, as far as I see it, is to minimize the amount of this stuff that we do. The lower right quadrant is the stuff that I just call tasks. You kind of just want to do it efficiently. You want to get it out of the way and you want to move forward.
Is there some sort of ideal balance you think of how much of your life should be in each of these quadrants?
My experience is that many of us have almost nothing in that upper right quadrant. That energy lights up all the other areas of your life. Everything starts to become really clear, your priorities become clear, and you have a lot more energy for everything else.
We are still in a fairly raw economic moment, even though the economy is improving. Do you think this matrix can be applied to lots of people who are struggling to pay their bills, get their kids fed out the door to school? Do you get any discomfort with trying to say, here's how you put some fun back in your life?
I've thought about that a lot. And as a mom of a very busy toddler, it's challenging to find the so-called me time, right, in a day.
And make it cheap.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't come cheaply. What I've found is I need to cut myself slack in other areas in order to prioritize that stuff. So it might be that my deal with myself is that I take it easy on the screen time for my kid and say, you know what? He gets half an hour a day so that I can write for half an hour a day.
I've seen a lot of people get sort of snowed by whatever the dream project is. You have a wonderful metaphor to flossing your teeth. Can you explain that?
Yeah. This is lifted shamelessly from Leo Babada. Rather than trying to floss your teeth every day and get into the teeth flossing habit, just floss one tooth. It's so preposterously easy that if you don't do it, you'll feel silly. And once you do one, you'll feel silly not doing two or not doing at least all your upper teeth or whatever it is, you know? So it's sort of about what's that first little snowflake that starts to make a snowball.
So my producer just hopped in my ear and she wants to know where each of us fall on this axis, where we are. How balanced are you, Lauren?
I think all of us have something in each quadrant. I have a lot of autonomy and freedom in my life, so I'd say I'm definitely on the more energized side of the spectrum. And I try to balance myself between, you know, other people's priorities and my own. I would say I'm kind of right in that middle ground. Middle upper. That would be me. How about you?
Oof. I definitely can get a little martyry. I recognize that about myself. But I was very sick a couple of years ago, and one of the things I learned was how to take time off. And so I learned how to take a day and go fly fishing. That has edged me more up toward fun and purpose. And I have learned that purpose energizes me probably more than anything else. So like reporting a great story, then I'm on fire. Lauren Bacon is a business and leadership coach. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Maybe you've never been asked, hey, what do your quadrants look like? Well, we want to know. Tell us where you'd show up on Lauren's chart by visiting marketplaceweekend.org. Now we have a story about what happens as the world transitions to mobile phones. Prices have fallen and more people across the globe are getting rid of landlines. But as we rush to continually buy the latest model, what happens to all our old phones? Many of them are finding their way to West Africa, where the environment is suffering as a result. Our partners at the BBC bring us this story from correspondent Tamasine Ford reporting from Abidjan in Ivory Coast.
This is the Marché Noir, the black market. It's packed with rows of stalls, all just selling one thing, mobile phones. Everything from this old trusty Nokia that simply just texts and calls to the latest smartphone that's more like a handheld computer. And they're cheap, really cheap. This smartphone here will set you back as little as $8. But as more people want the latest model, more phones are being thrown away. Phone repairman Adu Felicien negotiates a price with a customer. He sits in his shack, surrounded by sacks of old phone parts. Wires and bits of broken phones are sprawled on the desk in front of him.
We throw the waste in the bin just to get rid of it, because it hangs around the streets in the reach of children.
Even with hundreds of repair shops, like Felicien's, thousands of phones and phone parts are still being thrown away. And a lot of them end up in here, in the Abrié Lagoon in the heart of the city. It's the end of the journey for much of Abidjan's waste, where it either festers or gets washed out to sea. From afar, it looks beautiful, but as you get up close, you can see the litter, and the smell is incredible. A mixture of sewage, rotting food, and just generally foul-smelling stuff. And this is the problem. The waste, if it's not dealt with, can become a toxic hazard. Staff at Ivory Coast's first mobile phone recycling centre sort through bags of broken phones. They collect them from repair shops, paying per kilo. Everything is separated, the plastic, the batteries, the screens and the electrical parts. Isabelle Gabou, the director of the Electronic Waste Project, shows me around.
It's really important to recycle because more and more we're realising we are suffering from diseases that we can't explain. We are not a rich country. We are a developing country. So for me it is very important because it will enable people to be doing better.
The waste is packed up and sent to France for recycling. The first shipment left the country in July and the second is due at the beginning of next year. Funded by mobile phone operator Orange, it's now their fifth centre in Africa. Back at Felicien's shop, he tells me they no longer throw anything away. Everything is saved and then sold to the centre. They make a bit of money and at the same time stop worrying about the kids picking through the dangerous waste. West Africa is known as the world's main dumping ground for electronic waste. Ivory Coast is doing its part to turn this around. But recycling facilities like this are still very rare. It may have already collected 10 tonnes of old mobile phones, but it's estimated that is less than 1% of the total waste out there.
That story came to us from our partners at the BBC. And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Our show is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. To read more and see more, come visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org. And we love your tweets. Keep sending them our way. We're at Marketplace WKND. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, stories of how you made your Thanksgiving finances work. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening. This is APM.